Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the SVR broadcast on this 28th day of September. We're here with my co-host, John Stacy, and also T-Bird, the owner of that website. We're certainly happy to have her aboard. And today in our interview will be with Dr. Bash. He writes IMEs that for veterans, and also his associate, John Brown, helps him with him. And so John will be joining us here in a little bit. So we'll get on with it with Dr. Bash. Dr. Bash, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you.
You want to kind of fill us in on how you arrive at a diagnosis? I mean, I know there's a certain amount of paperwork or that's pertinent for you to be able to write up an opinion.
Yeah. My medical opinions are based on a review of the claims file. And oftentimes in the claims file, there's a lot of medical data that hasn't been looked at carefully historically. So, for example, a veteran might be in service and had a corpsman or nurse practitioner or somebody with a less than MD degree take care of them and not necessarily make an analysis of their signs and symptoms. So that's one way I do to help the veteran with the diagnosis. And something else I can do is in my IME, I can ask for extra tests. So, for example, maybe the patient needs an MRI scan or CT scan or angiogram or 24-hour urine or something like that to better analyze what his medical problems are. So if we get the additional testing done, then the diagnosis becomes more clear.
Okay, Dr. Bash, this is John. Could you give a listener
how much information do you need? Go ahead, John.
Could you give us a little bit of background of, you are a neuro radiologist, right?
Yeah, I'm trained as a radiologist, and radiologists review the whole body system. So we do training in orthopedics and gastrointestinal and general urinary. So all those systems come to us by way of imaging, so ultrasounds and CT scans. And then after I did all that training, then I went and did neuro training, which was 1 year at Baltimore and 2 years at NIH doing research in MRI. So I'm able to look at the whole body through the imaging aspect of things. A lot of times the diagnosis is based on imaging because it's the one test that really tells you what's going on. Mm-hmm. So somebody else was asking about how much information I need. It's best for me to see all the information, the whole C file, and anything else the patient has in and out of service, because then I can do a complete review of what's happening with the patient.
That sounds good. That sounds really good. That's an asset to have, especially when, you've got a doctor that can actually know how to decipher a lot of films and, make some diagnosis conclusions on the films. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, oftentimes I find the films can be misread. I had a case yesterday where a guy had hypertension for many years, and I got his chest x-ray, and it was read as normal, but I looked at it, and his heart was a little bit big. So a large heart on a chest x-ray is important for the medical diagnostic code, but it's also important for his treatment.
Oh, okay. When you do your IMOs, I guess the member actually, or the patient actually, they send you all the information, right? And you do it that way, and do you do the actual examinations, or do you just do like records and films?
Well, I'm able to do both. I live in Maryland for most of the year, and I go to California for the summers. So oftentimes when I'm moving around, patients will meet me, in different locations, like in Maryland. They'll come to my office and I can do an exam on them.
Okay.
Or sometimes patients will get a Southwest flight in the airport, and I'll do a little exam at the airport for them, reflexes and watch them walk and things like that.
Okay.
So I can do both types. Sometimes the VA, if the VA physician has done a CMP exam and they've done a physical examination, then sometimes it's good for me to do a physical examination so I can compare my examination with the VA doctor found.
Oh, okay.
Or a lot of times I can just do a record review. So if the patient hasn't had a CMP exam by a VA doctor or a QTC, then I can do the record review and then look at it that way. And oftentimes that's successful in giving the accurate diagnosis and the correct reading.
Okay. Do you want to give out your website address?
I use www.veteranswithanSMEDadvisor.com.
Okay.
Another good way to find me is just Google Dr. Bash, and all my stuff will show up on there, too.
Okay. And from reports that I've read and things I've read, you are a veteran yourself, right?
That's right. Yeah, 100% disabled.
Okay. You're just like me.
Yeah.
You okay?
Yes, I have a cervical spine injury. So I've had that for 27 years of mine. My spine injury took a long time for the VA to work out. It took about 7 years for them to get the diagnosis and the rating correct. So, you know, the VA system is complicated even for me to try and navigate.
Yeah, it took me 14 from my date that I was discharged to actually got my claim. I had a C-spine injury too at C5,
yeah.
C6, and it's been a long road.
Yeah.
But, so now we touched on a show that actually we were going to discuss. I guess you were wanting to really go into like a diagnosis and then maybe a follow up with secondary conditions.
Yeah, the whole idea of secondary conditions is really important. And that's something that I notice a lot of the VA doctors don't look at. And the VA system doesn't really ask the VA doctors to look at it. They oftentimes, you know, ask the VA doctors to talk about one very specific narrow diagnosis when he does his CMP exam. So, say, for example, somebody has hypertension. So hypertension can affect the kidney system. It can affect the heart. It can affect the brain, the eyes. So those other systems should be looked at carefully. And, you know, subtle signs of damage should be rated as they appear.
Oh, okay. I used to follow. Yeah, the kidney. I can see where the kidneys would relate to hypertension because of the, I guess, the pressure on the vessels itself would cause damage to the kidney. Is that right?
Yeah, right. The kidneys filter a lot of blood, and so when the pressure comes in high, it can damage the kidneys. Once again, I had a guy this week that had hypertension, you know, plus minus controlled for many years, like maybe 20 years, 25 years. So I knew that his heart was probably bigger than it was on X-ray. But I also knew that all that blood pressure on his kidneys over time should probably cause some changes to his kidneys. So the routine lab tests that people do, the BU and creatinine, don't really show subtle changes in kidney damage. So what I usually do is I ask the patient to get a 24-hour urine and look for creatinine clearance. And so with this guy, we did a creatinine clearance, and the lower level normal is like 97, and his clearance was like 83. So his kidneys are showing subtle changes of damage with the 24-hour creatinine clearance, whereas his BUN and his creatinine were normal on his lab tests.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that the VA has to deal with as a secondary condition as a raging to his hypertension.
Good deal. That sounds wonderful. That sounds like you're doing this guy a really good deal.
I'm trying to look at all the... I think that's kind of what the system's supposed to be, is look at all the different aspects of it. But once again, those are all secondary things that can cause... Same thing, the same guy had a little stroke in his brain. He has what's called a lacunar infarct, and lacunar infarcts can be caused secondary to hypertension. So he had, you know, another organ system in the brain that was affected by his long-standing high blood pressure.
Now, those issues, I guess, once they're connected, would be basically secondary to his hypertension, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. But they would be...
And then you can get secondary things due to treatment, you know, medication effects. So, you know, now this guy, same thing. This guy had hypertension for many years, and they had him on antihypertensives, so then he started losing his erectile function. And that was a direct result of his antihypertensive medication.
So, I guess, do they pay an SMC for that, or is that something different VA does?
Maybe a K award, maybe, huh?
Oh, okay. It used to be, what was it, like $90 a month?
It's about that. It's a K for loss of creative uses.
Oh. Okay. That's good. But, T-Bird, do you have anything to add?
No, I'm just really interested. Dr. Bash, one, I want to thank you for coming on the show and writing that article for us for the headit.com website about the IMO Nexus letter. And, you know, by the time a veteran gets to the point where they need to contact you, what kinds of things should they have ready for you, and what kind of time frame should they expect the IMO to be finished in?
Yeah, well, I'll talk the time frame first. The time frame, it depends on, you know, my workload. Sometimes patients have acute things happen, you know, medical things happen. Also, they have acute VA things happen. Like, I can sometimes go and be an expert witness down at the DVA, for example. And so those things will show up like on a week's notice sometimes. Or
right.
I go to an expert witness to be to the regional office. So that stuff slows down. The other thing is if the cases are big, like if a guy sends me a box that's, or three or four boxes, 10,000 pages, you know, that kind of thing will slow me down. It slows me down for that patient, but also it slows me down for future patients because I'm bogged down, you know.
Right.
But, so usually, you know, within a couple of weeks, I try and get my thing done. What I do now, what I try to do is have the patients remind me by email and say, you know, give me an artificial deadline by email because that's a good way to keep me on track.
Right.
Each patient's like my secretary and say, you know, I sent the records and then you have all the records and then you give me a couple of weeks and start bugging me. That's a good way to keep me going. What I need to see is, you know, if they can get, you know, the imager, so I always tell them they should get copies of their x-rays. And that's good for them medically because what happens is the x-ray systems, the hospitals or clinics will destroy those x-rays over time. So if the patient gets those and puts them under their bed or wherever they want to store them, it's a good place for them, just for their future medical care and also if I need them for review. So that's always an important thing to get. Then they should try and gather, you know, of course, gather all the records they can from their local doctors if they've seen those guys and any old records they have that they might have. Then they should also, you know, get one full copy of their claims file so they have that in hand. And then, you know, if they have any bloody statements or spouse statements or parent statements or brother and sisters, any of those kind of things that they have that they can get, they should, you know, gather up. And then what I could do is have them make a full copy of all that stuff, a paper copy, and then send a paper copy to me with that information along with anything the VA's done. Now, one thing really important that the VA does that they should always send me is if they have copies of those CMP exams. Now, I've had a lot of problems recently trying to get copies of CMP exams, particularly when they come from QTC. And for some reason, QTC says that they can't release it to the patient, they have to go to the VA. So I had a really bad situation where a guy I did an exam on him and he had a prostate mass. And the QTC examiner had done the exam the year before and they had found that mass, but they didn't tell the patient. So he had a one year lag time between when I saw the case and we still had a hard time getting the QTC report. So, you know, those QTC reports, the doctor can pick up a lot of things that can be life-threatening, and the patient should have access to that stuff in a timely way, number one, for his life-threatening problems, but two, for his VA claims process. So if they can get copies of those CMP exams from the VA doctor, the original, because I also notice that sometimes the VA reports, you know, sometimes the claims will cherry-pick stuff out of the CMP exams that are negative to the patient, not necessarily provide the whole thing in context. So it's always good for me to see the CNP reports. It's always good for me to see the QTC reports, and it's always good for me to see any of the VA decisions and documents that have been produced so I can have a full picture of what's going on.
Oh, I see. So somebody puts a package together for you. Go ahead and put all the VA in one section, anything that has to do with the claim, including the CMP exam, which we always recommend people go to the release of information office at the local VA hospital a couple weeks after they had their CMP exam and ask for a copy of that themselves.
Yeah, yeah. How long does it take you usually to get that?
You know, I really, honestly, I think it depends on the VA you go to. It's not, you know, it's supposed to, like my VA told me it doesn't take more than 2 weeks. Somebody else told me, you know, their VA told them it'd be at least a month. So.
Yeah.
You know how it is with the VAs. It's different answers depending on which VA you go to.
This whole idea of records is, you know, records are really, really important. And, you know, a lot of times the VA will say that I haven't had haven't looked at the whole claims file. So that's why it's so important for me to see the claims file so they can't say that I didn't have a full record to look at. But and so I've had bad, some bad luck sometimes trying to get those claims, the whole claims file along, you know, along with the CMP. So what I've had the veterans do is write their congressman and just ask them to, you know, one sentence, please ask the VA to provide me a copy of my claims file in some kind of timely manner. And I've had pretty good luck with that.
Yeah, you know, when you getting a copy of the CNP exam is an entirely different thing than getting a copy of your claims folder. That takes a lot more time, and you have to go through the VA regional office. And, you know, I've seen it take, you know, a month, and then I've also seen people have to re-request it over and over and over again. So maybe the best thing to tell people is, you know, if you're going in for like an increase, to go ahead and request a copy of your CFAL because you're going to need it at some point.
Yeah, I've got patients. A lot of times, by the time patients get to me, they're down the pipeline quite a ways as far as the appeal process goes.
Right.
And they might even put me in a bind where I have 60 or 30 days to respond, you know, to something that the DVA wants or whatever. And they may not have a copy of the claims file. So then in that situation, if the claims file takes 6 months or a year or, you know, even 30 days to get to me, and it takes me a few days to go through it, that they could miss the deadline. So in a situation like that, what I usually do is I have the patient write to the VA and tell them that they have a medical opinion pending from Dr. Bash and that they want them to hold the decision until Dr. Bash has had a chance to review the full C file for maybe 30 days or something like that. And so that way the patient doesn't get themselves in a situation where they lose their, you know, retroactive date, or they lose their claim because they can't get an IME for me that I can't do until I have the claims file.
Right, that makes sense. And I could see them, if you didn't have the entire claims folder, then naturally they would immediately say, well, you didn't look at the entire claims folder. And though we've gone to electronic records, like, for example, if I go to a CNP at the VA hospital, the CNP exam is electronically transferred to the VA. However, your claims folder is still all paper. So they have to put that in the mail, and it has to get mailed to the VA. So it's not... Everything's not electronic and as easy to get.
Have you had good luck at the CNP exams from the QTC process?
No, I've never had any experience with that.
Anybody else on the radio have any experience with
Dr. Bash, we've had a lot of folks on the site that you know, we always encourage them to go to try to get their, you know, CNP reports, you know, so many days after the exam. And most people that I deal with that just reading the board and knowing what they try to do with QTC, and they say it's next to impossible to get records off the QTC examination because they begin to tell them that, you know, the information belongs to the VA, and they tell them to go to the VA and get it.
Yeah, that's been my experience, too. I don't know if, how we can help the veteran with that somehow from a system standpoint.
I'm not sure from a system standpoint either, because that's sort of a – and there's several of these in the VA system, these – circular points where you can't seem to find an end, you know, we can't help you, go see them. And then they say, well, we don't have it because they haven't sent it to us yet. And then, you know, and they just send you round and round. And I'm not sure systematically what can be done about that. It's, confounds me sometimes, the inability to get a simple yes or no answer.
The biggest thing that worries me is, you know, number one, patients oftentimes can't get medical care until you get a claim.
Right.
So they can die or you lose the limb and things like that. Or the second thing, they can lose your claim based on those deadlines. So that's why I always have them tell the VA that they should hold their decisions until they, you know, until they have a chance to get their information from the VA.
Well, that's good that you tell veterans that, because, you know, we're not versed and all this VA lingo, so we wouldn't even know that. And that's another important part of who you get your IMO from, that they understand how the VA system works and can help you with things like that. let them know and tell them I need to review the records. Because the system is difficult. And you're right. The scariest thing is that the veteran can't get any medical care while they're trying to prove that they should be able to get medical care.
Right. Catch 22. Yeah, you know, the medical opinion is really powerful, and if the doctor knows the importance of it. Like, I go to those deviated, you know, as an expert witness.
Right.
And I'll go there as an expert witness, and I'll make my little statement and show x-rays and stuff. And then what I usually do there is we ask the deviate judge to hold the record open for 60 or 90 days for me to write a secondary report to answer the questions the judge has. And they do that automatically. And they, in the same way, they'll do it pretty automatically for the claim. If you tell them that you have a medical opinion that's pending and you want them to hold the decision until that medical opinion is produced, then they really have a duty to automatically honor that request. That's a real powerful tool to help the veteran at least get his, you know, get his decision. You know, once they decide in the negative, it takes a long time to appeal it. So if you have to wait a little while before the decision is made, it can save them a lot of time in the whole process.
Right. I agree.
And they get medical care, maybe they can get medical care. The other thing I do, you know, that medical care thing is another issue that's important. So, for example, if I'm doing my exam or my report, either one of them, and I find some testing that needs to be done, like I talked about a minute ago, if I ask for that test, like if I write a request to, I just write a little letter to the veteran and say this patient needs a chest x-ray for his claims process. And then he takes it to his VA doctor, and his VA doctor will order that or the hospital. Some of the hospitals give the patient a hard time, so we're not doing that. But I think there's a rule that says that part of the, you know, the duty assists, if there's some testing that needs to be done, then the VA has the responsibility to do that stuff. And so I've had sometimes had the veteran take that request to even to the hospital director to have it honored. And that way, because sometimes that test will show up something that's important for the medical care, and then by doing that test, the VA kind of takes responsibility for the medical care too at the same time.
Right, I agree. Dr. Bash, it seems we have John Brown on the line. Is he your partner in this?
Yeah, John's like my administrative assistant. Hey, John.
John, are you there yet? I think Stretch is bringing him online.
Yeah, I'm bringing him on right now.
Hello, it's John speaking.
Hey, John, hey. Dr. Bash.
Hey, Dr. Bash, how are you doing today?
Good, we're on the radio here. I told him you're my administrative assistant.
Okay, all right, that's true. Are you live right now, or?
Yeah, we're live on the radio. I was just talking to him about, they were asking about the IME, and we talked a little about secondary conditions, and we were talking about one big problem was trying to get the claims file, and I told him that maybe slow, and it can be deadly to their health, and also can be, you know, damaging to their claim.
And absolutely. You're not on the radio now, are you? You're done with it, right?
Yeah.
No, we're on the radio live now.
Oh, you are? Okay. Sorry about that. Hello there, listeners. All right. Yes, Dr. Bash, you're absolutely right about the need for speeding up the process to get a copy of that claims file. It's beyond ridiculous, to be honest with you. It takes anywhere from 6 months to a year in a lot of regional offices to get a copy of the claims file.
Now, is just absurd.
Well, it is. Hey, it is. Yes, Dr. Bash.
So I told him that sometimes I have my patient write a letter to their congressman if it's been slow and ask the congressman to ask the VA for the claims file. How does that, when you were in the VA, how was that handled if a congressional person asked for the claims file? Would you ask me that?
No, really, the congressional liaison in the office was charged with communicating with the congressional people. And, you know, there's still the rules and regulations that they have to follow internally. And I think unless somebody's life is practically at stake, or you know, they're about to lose their home, and you can prove it, I don't think there is any true expedited process. That's what I found out anyhow.
That's been a lot of our experiences also.
How about through the Freedom of Information? Does that because that requires them to respond like in 30 days and things like that. Is that faster that way, you think, maybe?
You're absolutely right, Dr. Bash. It's supposed to be it's a 30-day turnaround under the FOIA Freedom of Information Act. Mm-hmm. According to VA regulations, they're supposed to turn it around that fast. And they're supposed to send a letter saying, if they can't, they're supposed to send a letter saying, look, we've got your request. We're certainly going to process it. It's taking a little longer, but we'll get to it as soon as possible. But that isn't even done. I haven't seen that accomplished in my contacts with most regional offices. I must say that the short contact I've had as an appeals agent with St. Paul, that's where I used to work, they do turn it around pretty quick. I was impressed, and I'm not just saying that. I've been comparing different regional offices as I represent veterans, and it's a problem. I mean, I'm sure other attorneys, and I've talked to other attorneys. I'm not an attorney. I'm an accredited agent. But attorneys that I have talked to have suggested the same thing, that it's just this is a huge handicap for the veteran to not be able to review the files, to know how to develop it.
Right.
It can cause an eclipse of their benefits because sometimes the claim is decided while they're waiting for the records.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's a problem.
Yeah, I guess the best way is still just to fill out the Freedom of Information Act form and send it to your regional office and request the C file as soon as possible, because it could take God only knows how long to get it.
It varies. It does vary, and I don't know what other process there is. That is the process, and they do have a FOIA contact in the regional offices that I just kind of came across looking up some things for Dr. Bash. They have a specific FOIA contact at the regional office with a telephone number. So that's something that I wasn't aware of until recently.
I wasn't aware of that either. I would imagine that would be listed under the VA's website under locations. If you went to your regional office, it probably should be listed there.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is. I checked. I think it's under like www.va.gov. And then there's a section in there for FOIA, F-O-I-A, Freedom of Information Act. And that's the section you want to go to, and that's where I found the listed numbers.
Okay, then what you want to do is go to, and I have it up here on my screen, is www.f as in Frank, O as in Oscar, I as in India, A as in Adam, .va.gov.
No, I take it back. It's www.va.gov, their regular website.
Forget then a backslash, first. Then FOIA.
Well, maybe. I don't know. I didn't try that.
No, I just tried. It's okay. Up on my screen.
Okay. And in there somewhere is a list of regional offices with telephone numbers for contacts.
Okay.
I'm not in front of a computer. I apologize. I'm actually, Dr. Bash, I'm actually traveling. I met a veteran this morning earlier, and I was trying to get back by a certain time, and anyhow, I pulled over in my car. That's where I'm at.
So I was talking about the records. We talked about how important it is to have the records so I can look historically and maybe look to see if the diagnosis and service is correct. You want to talk about that a little bit, John, about how the diagnosis can evolve over time?
Well, absolutely. I mean, a perfect example, Dr. Bash, is something that you've handled for over 20 years, and that's why I make most of my referrals to you, is because of your experience. And the issue is, let's say that you had an injury in service, and let's say there is no clear diagnosis, but there's something in the treatment record in the military service that indicates there was an injury. And let's say there is no clear diagnosis, like I said, but maybe 20 years later, you're looking at the file and you need the file in order to see that, then let's say they have a couple of buddies that actually witnessed the accident and attested from their observations that, yeah, he absolutely hurt his knee. He was limping on it for at least 2 months before he ever went to see anybody. And now you've diagnosed him with something that is without any intercurring accidents or anything. You've diagnosed him with a degenerative disc disease or a degenerative joint disease or something, and can attribute it to it, to going back to the service. But again, in that case, there was no clear diagnosis then, but clearly there was an injury. I don't know if that's what you wanted me to hit on, Dr. Bash.
Yeah, because I want to take one step further. So now, for example, on that scenario that John just gave, if they had an X-ray, if we had an X-ray that was taken, you know, maybe 10 years or 15 years after the injury, then oftentimes in those X-rays, they might show degenerative arthritis or some disc disease. And I can look at that, and I can say with some accuracy whether that degenerative arthritis is appropriate for the patient's age or whether it's out of proportion to his age, which means that that accident and service caused that arthritis to be bad at that point in time.
Sure,
the X-ray can
sure.
help me sometimes in that situation.
Right.
The same thing with, you know, using lung disease and brain disease. There's places in the body where the X-rays and they're very helpful in establishing the time of the injury.
There are some, and Dr. Bash, you know, you and I have talked about this before. There are some other types of diseases that are presumptive diseases that don't have to show up right in the service treatment records. But, for instance, I believe it's multiple sclerosis is one that sticks out. That has a 7-year presumptive period.
Yes.
And so if the symptoms show up within 7 years, and it looks like maybe it was the beginning of multiple sclerosis within 7 years of their separation from active duty, again, that takes a doctor. I mean, it takes a doctor to, like yourself, with experience, to understand what you're looking for there. And I think a lot of the problem is getting a doctor, trying to find time for our private doctor to understand what the rules and regulations are. And that's why, you know, on my website, I've recommended to contact you, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to MS for a second. Yeah, I've done a lot of those cases. I've done some research in that. And a lot of times, once again, the imaging, the MRI scan, I can read as being positive for MS if I see it during that time period. But there's also other little subtle things that I've noticed. That's why the records are so important. So I've won some cases with patients with MS, which is devastating disease. These are really sick patients, you know, that need benefits. And they might have, like, hearing exams and service where the hearing is better and then worse and better and worse, goes up and down over the years they're in service, which hearing doesn't need to do that. It stays, you know, constant or gets worse. It doesn't fluctuate. Same thing with the vision exam. I've had patients that had, like, color blindness on one test, and then they had normal color vision and then had color blindness again, or they had some acute vision changes up and down that vary with time during service time. So those subtle things that can be picked up from the service time physical examinations have been useful to help patients
get
their benefits.
Exactly, Doc. Without Dr. Bash, you and I know, without getting a copy of the actual complete claims file, the way that the VA weighs the evidence is also changed. I mean, if you haven't looked at the file and you're providing an opinion, they're gonna give less probative value to your opinion than if you had seen the file. Again, something that would be almost imperative on behalf of the veteran for the doctor to look at the file.
Right.
Dr. Bash, John?
Yeah.
Could you explain the importance of, say, if a veteran sends you his records, especially X-rays and films, the importance of sending older documents to, like, you know, maybe MRIs you had 10 years ago?
Yeah. The it's an important question. When I was a first year resident, the little axiom was that old films make you smart, and the idea is that those old X-rays are really useful because they provide a baseline. So if somebody has old X-rays, you know, they get closer and closer back to a service time and might show his injury, you know, acutely. And so those old X-rays are really important. And like I said, you know, a lot of times the hospitals will throw those away now. So all patients should really gather all their old X-rays and put them under their bed somewhere and keep them, because if they destroy them, then they're, you know, they're gone forever.
I know when dealing with the VA, went digital. And a lot of older records were, on hard film.
Yeah.
And when they went digital, they purged a lot of them older records. And I don't know how the hospitals keep them now, but it's imperative that you get the older records too.
Yeah, yeah. And the films last a long time. I've had patients recently that have had some of these electronic images put on discs, and the quality of the discs is bad, such that the discs are starting to break down, like even in a year or two. So, if they store images on, electronic images on discs, they should make sure they have really good quality, because if those discs break down and they don't have backup, then they could lose their data again.
I've never tried to get copies of my x-rays from the VA. That's something, I mean, do they, are they okay with that? Yeah. Are they giving them out?
And this is some work I did at the DVA. I actually was suggesting to the DVA they should process all those x-rays, because the x-rays are just like the medical record. They're just part of the medical record, and they should be, really, the VA should be traveling those x-rays with the paper records throughout the system. If the veteran wants them, he just tells them, he wants his x-rays, or he tells him he wants them for his doctor to review, and I can review them, or his local doctor can review them. But there are the patient's property, and they can get them.
It's important to understand, of course, the difference between requesting a record from the VA regional office where your claims file is kept, and the VA medical center, where that's where your medical records would be kept if you're being treated at the VA over the years. They don't.
That's a good point, John.
You have to go to the medical center, right? You have to go to wherever your x-rays are taken. It might be a clinic, medical center, or whatever. Yeah.
The same with going back 20 or 30 years, Dr. Bash, you and I have experienced this, where, they say, well, I had an auto accident, and I was treated in Oakland, California, at the VA hospital, or at the military hospital. I was in the Navy. And those records aren't automatically sent to the regional office near there either. You have to go directly to that military hospital and get those records. And the VA is pretty good about, if you tell them, they have an obligation to either get a yay or a nay, a positive or negative on whether those records are available, and they have to continue looking for them until they get a positive or negative response. They'll do the work for you. You just have to tell them this is where those records are. And they're very good about it. They're very thorough about that, I might add.
I mean, the example that, that's a good point. The patient told the VA where the records were. The VA asked for them a couple times. And then the police didn't respond. The patient went themselves and found it and brought it, and it was great for the case.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So you have to be rigorous.
That is true, because when I was in the Navy, I had to have 2 abdominal surgeries a year apart at Balboa Naval Hospital. And I thought those records would go with my service medical records, but I found out later that I had to request them specifically from Balboa.
Exactly.
And they showed up for you? You got them?
Nope. They sent me a letter saying that they were not there anymore.
Yeah.
They were, too long. I waited too long.
Yeah, they burned up in the fire at St. Louis.
That's always a problem, too. And that is a problem. That or they can't find the service treatment records, which doesn't happen all that often. But when it does, of course, it puts the veteran at a huge disadvantage in trying to establish service connection for something that happened in service, and they don't have a record of it. And really, the only hope he or she would have at that point in time as a veteran would be to try and get a buddy statement, would be one option, or two, to see if there's any older records from the private community to obtain that might help define what happened back then.
There's one thing I used when I talked to the patients in a situation like that. I asked them if the treating doctor ever told them a diagnosis, because I think there's something about how if the patient heard a diagnosis, he can repeat that, accurately. So if you went into the hospital and they said he had, a heart attack 20 years ago, then that's something that has a little more strength to it if the record's missing than just the fact that he went to the hospital,
If the doctor were to attest to the fact that he remembers it?
If a doctor told him that he had some sort of a diagnosis, like he went to the hospital and the doctor did an evaluation and sat him down and said, you have this disease, then the patient can, you know, tell me about that disease, and I can use that as some evidence.
That does make sense. They don't always tell you, though, what... I mean, like, I ended up having to have a hysterectomy in the service, and I kept asking about this bulging on my left side, and they told me it was the way they sewed me up, and there wasn't anything they could do about it. Now, last year I had an attack of colitis, and they told me it was a hernia. And they said, I don't know why they would have told you it's the way they sewed you up. It's clearly a hernia. So, it just doesn't help with my confidence in them, you know.
That's going back to when you were in the military that happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they've got the wrong diagnosis is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. They said, right. You know, it's just... The way they sewed you up causes your left side of your stomach to stick out. But well, turns out it's a hernia.
You know, a medical opinion, like, you know, let's say Dr. Bash's independent medical evaluation with his review of that, and, you know, he's a physician with the diagnosis, a current opinion suggesting that, look, this was misdiagnosed. I think you brought that up earlier, Dr. Bash. This was misdiagnosed. Back in the military, this really looks to have been a hernia. And, you know, he provides a medical opinion. The VA can look at it from their compensation examiners, and they would review it and come up with their opinion. And you never know. I mean, you know.
No, that's a great point.
It's an important point. You know, I teach some med students that issue. I said when you review a record, always don't be afraid to change the diagnosis because – oftentimes the diagnosis before can be inaccurate, and so if you keep propagating that through the record, it doesn't do any good for medical care, and it doesn't do any good for benefits. And so in that situation, I would look at it, and if the signs and symptoms were consistent over time and you hadn't any other surgeries or accidents or traumas in that area, then in my opinion, it would be that that hernia that you have now is the same hernia that you had before and was caused by the surgery, and the diagnosis was wrong.
Right.
The you same know, thing. Go ahead, Tabor.
Well, I was just thinking how good it is to have a fresh set of eyes look at your service medical records, because just because the military doctor diagnosed you with something or didn't diagnose you with something doesn't necessarily mean it was true. For example, they diagnosed me with a bladder infection for 3 months until they found out I didn't have a bladder infection. I was bleeding internally because of an ovarian tumor. So,
right.
You know, it. Right. I mean, stuff happens. But if a doctor is looking at the records, it's going to be much easier for him to go, well, that's weird. You know, 3 months ago she had this, and now 3 months she's got this again, and they got this again, and got this again, and this looks more like this like, than it does like that.
Yeah, it's like that comment I said about x-rays. Old x-rays make you smart, and same thing, old records make you smart because you can look historically and see what's going on. And it's not, you know, it's not really fair for the VA because they – there's not that many doctors laying around in the system. You know, the raters and the lawyers are not physicians. And so stuff that's, like, easy for me is difficult for them. And so that's why you get a lot of sort of wrong ratings and things don't match up. Because and they're not able to change the diagnosis. I mean, even if the lawyer realizes that it was wrong, he can't go through and say that he can't really pick and choose which diagnosis because he's not a physician, you know.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, a rating specialist in the Veterans Administration, I had been a rating specialist in the VA before, and it's a real challenging job because of the, you know, the amount of records and decisions they want pushed out, of course, that has an impact on quality. It clearly does. So let's say that a typical rater in one of the regional offices has to rate 4 cases a day. And that could be up to 7 different disability issues in each case. That's a lot of issues to look at in one day and to provide a quality decision. Of course, they only have, really, when
that's
they look at the entire record.
Excuse me, John, that's 2 hours. That's 2 hours for seven issues. It's like 15 minutes an issue or something like that, right?
It is. It is. And yeah. We're only allowed as a rater two errors in a year, two critical errors in a year. And if that, if you had two critical errors in a year under the quality assurance program, then you go under, you could go under, you know, automatically, but they could put you under a, you know, like a training kind of a overview, watching all the readings that you do scenario, which just kind of adds insult to injury a little bit because of the numbers. But, I mean, they're very highly qualified. They know how to weigh the evidence. But the key to a successful disability compensation rating is they have enough medical evidence that is positive on your side. That's all. That's the difference between getting service-connected and not getting service-connected. You have medical evidence. You have medical opinions. So, you know, if you were to weigh the evidence and you had three medical doctors that say no, and three medical doctors said yes, and they were, of the doctors, they were of a similar status from their experience and profession, then the benefit of the doubt is supposed to go to the veteran. They should grant it. If they weigh the evidence and they feel the evidence that's against it weighs heavier than the positive evidence for the service connection, well, then their decision would be to rate against it. So they're really simply interpreting how to weigh the evidence from the medical opinions they do get from the doctors. It's the doctors that really decide this, with somebody ultimately the rater making decision, of course. But the evidence is the doctor's evidence primarily, although everything's taken into consideration.
Hey, John, you brought up another good issue, this idea of multiple medical opinions.
Yeah.
Like when I get a record, and like you said, it might be a few positives and a few negatives, I try and go through and look at each one of those medical opinions and make my own sort of analysis and maybe write about it in my opinion. So I'll say Dr. Smith, you know, had this opinion, but I agree with this parts of it, but I disagree with this part, the other part of it because they didn't see the whole record or whatever. And so I'll go through. And most doctors won't do that. They won't really go through and critically analyze the other physician's opinions, which makes it really difficult for the VA rater because then all the doctor's opinions look equal, you know, and they may not really be, when some of the physicians might not have the training and they might not really know what they're looking at or didn't really analyze it. So that, well, that's an aspect of things that's important.
Absolutely. You hit on a really important point, Dr. Bash, and that is, you know, I think just to reinforce the fact that private doctors that are working in the industry, they don't know what it is that they should be looking for. They don't know exactly what are the laws and regulations, how are they interpreted by the VA. You know, what is it that they're trying to provide information about, which are critical and key to a rater's interpretation. So the medical, you're right. I mean, most doctors in the private sector just don't know what it is that the VA's rules, how they operate. It's that. So you need some experience in that.
But even the VA doctors are oftentimes won't critically analyze other medical opinions in the report because, you know, some C&P guy may come along and he may have had maybe six medical opinions in the record and he doesn't oftentimes maybe acknowledge them or go through and agree or disagree with part, you know, with their opinion. So it makes it hard for the rater to referee that part of it.
It does. It does. It's a tough job. It's a tremendously rewarding job. But, you know, the philosophy of the VA is supposed to be grant it if you can and deny it if you must. And, you know, you always hope that you get a rater that has that philosophy.
That is a good philosophy. Yes, I agree. I would like a rater that has that philosophy.
For sure. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's how that's what the training mechanism teaches them. So,
you know, and I think that brings us back to the other point is in order to make it easy for them to do that, present the medical evidence.
Talk about development. Hey, John. Talk about development a little bit. Like, if you have a case that you need more medical evidence, how do you? What evidence do you have, and is that frowned on, or is it easy to do, and stuff like that?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, if you've got a case that does require additional medical opinions, knowing that they've got a compensation examination in the file, and their claim has been denied, and you've made a notice of disagreement and appeal to the VA regional office, and you need medical evidence. I mean, it's clear you have to have some medical evidence. Well, it's hard to write out on a in a letter form to give to the veteran to contact his private medical doctor to say, you know, can you try and interpret this for me? Again, that doctor isn't going to take the time to look at three volumes of medical records that are already in the VA claims file to say, yeah, I've really reviewed it all and I can give some. So it's difficult to get medical evidence. It's not easy.
Does it slow down your reading? Does it slow down your reading process? Your four cases a day, because that is bogs you down asking for evidence.
Well, as a VA raider, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, as a VA raider, of course, it comes to the raider supposedly ready to rate. All the evidence is in the file, and all the T's have been crossed, and the I's have been dotted. And it's a matter of getting the file, and so supposedly the evidence is in the file. You're looking at it, and the development is already done when you get it as a reader. Supposedly.
But what if you get it? What if you get it and there's not enough evidence? Do you have to
develop it? They absolutely stop, take a step back, and say, "Look, we need more development here." But they're not going to go out and develop it for the veteran. In other words, if they get evidence that's two medical opinions that say no, this isn't service connected, and the veteran provided one doctor's opinion suggesting that it is service connected. I mean, it's again, you have to weigh all the evidence in the claims file, but the more medical evidence you have, from a veteran's perspective, of course, and from a raider's perspective, if you have the evidence and you provide it to the VA, I think they'll do a fine job in making a decision. I do. If the evidence is there and they weigh the evidence properly and, you know, it's at least a reasonable doubt exists when there's even evidence for and against. Well, they're supposed to grant that, and they're experts at that. I must say that they have a lot of training in that area. They have to be both a legal and a medical kind of an expert, professional, and but still, the total reliance on a doctor's opinion or medical opinions is imperative. And
John, will they ever, the VA ever make kidney cancer a presumptive to Agent Orange?
They have not made kidney cancer presumptive to Agent Orange yet. And, you know, whether they ever do or not, you never know. The research continues, right? Dr. Bash, I know you had a great big book on this that, that you were showing me one day.
Yeah, Agent Orange is a good topic. You know, the, there is a presumptive list, but there's a lot of other diseases in there that aren't presumptive that I've won benefits for. And what I do is I go and look at the data inside the Agent Orange books, and a lot of those articles are supportive of the linkages for all those cancers. And so, like for kidney cancer, it might be 50 articles that support it and 20 that don't. So I use that as the preponderance of evidence. And even though the Institute of Medicine says, now the Institute of Medicine said that, that there's insufficient evidence, but there's that big court case that Hagel did that said that the Institute of Medicine can't be used as the reason to deny a claim. It has to be medical opinion. So I think kidney cancer is something that that should be searched next.
Possibly. I mean, the bookmark that the VA uses and that the raiders use, of course, in their regulations is that they wait for Congress to and the National Academy of Science. Of course, Dr. Vett, you're very familiar with those folks.
Yeah.
But the National Academy of Science is the one that gives some advice to Congress, basically, to say, okay, we want to add this to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, we want to add this. This condition is a presumptive condition related to Agent Orange. I mean, but right now, even though kidney cancer is not a presumptive condition related to Agent Orange, I think Dr. Bash is saying, well, there's still a lot of research out there that suggests that it could be. And it's not presumptive, though, is it?
No, but if it needs medical opinion. It has to be done the right way, but it can be a positive outcome.
Right, exactly. And the same goes for a variety of other issues. Asbestos-related cancers include not only mesothelioma and lung cancer, but they can include the gastrointestinal tract and I'm trying to think of the urinary tract and some of the others, you know. Yeah. And so it's still required, but those aren't presumptive. Again, that requires a clear medical opinion saying that it's more likely than not, or it's at least as likely as not. Again, the wording and the phrasing from a medical opinion is critical, whether the VA is going to accept it as positive evidence or not. Dr. Bash knows that from 20 years plus experience, you know. Most doctors don't. They don't know the verbiage. It's whether it's as likely as not or it's not as likely as not. Those are the kind of verbs that are used when you're getting a medical opinion. You want to get that type of opinion from a doctor, you know.
Probable and possible are killers, right? Probable and possible.
They are. Probable isn't going to do it. Yeah. Possible isn't going to do it. It has to be more definitive. You're right, Dr. Bash.
Dr. Bash, this is John. Asbestos is kind of my forte, I guess. I was an asbestos worker in the Navy. And the reason I'm asking the question, what type of imaging is necessary for to get a good diagnosis of asbestosis or asbestos, you know, of asbestos-related disease without doing an actual biopsy?
Yeah. Well, it depends what organ you're after, you know, because like John says, other organs can be involved with cancers. But if you're just looking at the lung, you know, chest x-ray is good. Some of the quality, it depends on the quality of the film, because the older chest x-rays might be better than some of the newer ones because the digital isn't actually quite as accurate as the plain film. That's why those old plain x-rays are really important to see. And then you can do CT scan, which is another good way you can look for pleural plaquing and look for interstitial changes. And also, you know, there may be a role for some of this pulmonary function testing too, because it can cause a restrictive type pattern in the lung. So the chest imaging is important.
You won't necessarily find the fibers in any type of scan, though. Let's say, I mean, they're kind of, you wouldn't necessarily see those type of fibers in the, let's say, the intestinal
tract. No, you see the secondary. Those fibers are microscopic, and you need, like, electron microscope to see them. Right. And they're actually pretty nasty to look at if you ever want to see them on the Internet. But but they get in there, and they're irritants. And so the irritant causes a little scar, basically, a little foreign body reaction, and that's with the pleural plaquing and some of the interstitial changes you see in the lung. But that takes a long time for that to show up.
Right, right.
Good deal.
Dr. Bash, I'd also like to mention on the article that you wrote for Hadit.com, you have listed quite nicely all those phrases, is due to or caused by, more likely than not, much more likely than not. And so if people need to find it, it's on the website, and it's you can just use a search for Dr. Bash, and it should pull the letter right up for you.
Oftentimes I put that in my report now because, like John was saying, a lot of these other doctors outside, even inside the VA, may not necessarily know the verbiage. That's why I put that in my report, so the doctor can read that and see what it means and what the words are that he needs to try and use.
Yes, it's very interesting because you can say the exact same thing in two different ways. And one way the VA gets it, and another way the VA doesn't. And I think that the writer's job is extremely difficult. And I think as they read through things, if it's written in the language that they understand, that they don't have to then interpret, it's beneficial for the veteran each and every time.
There's another huge philosophical issue that gets into the way physicians think. You know, that we're taught to try and do things with 90% accuracy. You know, people fall in 90% normal range. So we do our diagnosis and so on in clinical care. We try and be, you know, at least that accurate. But in, for the VA system, they want the things done as likely as not, which is like the 50% level. So if you ask a doctor, did this person have congestive heart failure in service, he's thinking at the 90% level, no. But if you look at it at the 50% level, it's yes.
Right. That's a very, very valid point. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how many look at it that way. Probably not that many.
Well, not because physicians are not trained. We're trained to do things. That's why there's a lot of grinding the gears in this process, because doctors are trained to look at it like they were in a medical center, and they don't realize it or understand this. So if the soldier's in the combat, he's out in the field somewhere and doesn't really have the data or the medical records to fall into. That's why the rules are at the 50% level to allow for some benefit of the doubt and the fact that the medical care is not world class. Sometimes in the combat zone,
excuse me, I'm sorry, Dr. Bash.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, I just didn't add that when the request goes over to the VA Medical Center for a compensation and pension examination, and the veteran goes to the hospital or to the clinic or wherever they go for their CNP exam, compensation and pension exam, as a part of that claims process, the VA doctors, certainly, the request is specific, saying, provide an opinion as to whether you think it is at least as likely as not, or not at least as likely as not. So the specific question is posed to the VA compensation doctors, whereas a private doctor never gets into that kind of verbiage at all.
Right.
Dr. Patrick is saying they know at the VA compensation, they're giving their opinion as to whether it's at least 50% or not, as likely as not, or so on. But a private doctor, I mean, no, they don't know that verbiage. They don't know, like you were mentioning earlier, that, you know, they just, the language, it's the semantics, it's how it's written is the key to how it's interpreted by the VA rater.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of hurdles for veterans to overcome to get their compensation. I mean, a guy or a gal just gets out of service and they're having problems with whatever part of their body system it is. And then they go to the VA, maybe they get medical care, maybe they apply for a claim, and they think that's it. They don't realize that they have to all of a sudden get really smart about the law and read old cases and see how they were. I mean, it can get quite, it can put a person in therapy who didn't even need to go in therapy.
You hit the nail on the head. There's no doubt about that.
You bring up a really good issue about that discharge physical. You know, some guys they get the option where they can have the physical or not. They should always opt for the physical. And then the doctor, philosophically, again, the doctor's not really looking that hard at things because it's going to be a lot more work on the way out the door, you know?
Right.
So I'm getting a lot of cases now where patients are in the process where they can do the VA exam and the military exam at the same time. And so some of my opinions now are being written before the patient even leaves the service. I do an exam before they even leave the service so I can compare my exam to the other exams the VA is doing while they're in the service before discharge processing things. That first step is really, really important.
Absolutely. Dr. Bash, and I think, too, that they really improved on that aspect of it. They knew they had to improve on that aspect of it, the military and the VA both. And I think they've made great strides there as far as making sure that they have a complete physical and it's coordinated even before they get out. Whereas, you know, in 1968 or 69 or 70, as an example, I can't tell you how many discharge separation physicals I've looked at, which are the same as my separation physical, which was check here. All you wanted to do was to get out of there. You weren't interested in saying, I've got a problem having me put them in a holding company so they could do more thorough examinations on you. You simply wanted to go home. And I would say 90% of the veterans are in that category. That throughout the folks that we deal with, they weren't in the separation exam is an important document that has probative evidence in evaluating this for claims purposes from the rating perspective. But again,
when you're in the military and you're getting out, no one takes the time to explain to you how important that physical is.
I think it's changing though. I think it's changed over the last few years with the most recent war. I do think that they're trying harder in the military and the VA to coordinate that. So there's a seamless kind of record. They're trying real hard to do that. I know they are.
Yeah, let me clarify that. I'm talking about previous. I think they are. They have gotten really better at it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think more active duty military members understand better the connection between the VA and getting a claim if they need one. And I think that they're explaining it better. And I think probably the physicals are a lot more detailed than they were when I got out.
And I get patients, like I said, I get patients call me now that are in service. And one area I can really help, again, like we talked about in the very beginning, was this testing part, because on the way out the door, sometimes the service doesn't want to do expensive MRI or cardiac testing or whatever else they need to work up the problem. So that's where I can get involved and make sure we get the diagnostic testing done so the diagnosis is correct before they leave the service, and then the rating can follow through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That would be, you know, that's the cat's meow with respect to weighing evidence. If you had something in service or shortly after service that documents it with the type of testing that Dr. Bash is talking about, I mean, you know, it's almost a given then, wouldn't you say, Dr. Bash?
Yeah, it makes it, I mean, it clears up the diagnosis and it's during service time, so, right.
Yeah. I must say that, you know, in Minnesota, for instance, the county, and this is national too, county veteran service officers, and I'm kind of the liaison for county veteran services nationally for Dr. Bash. County veteran service officers are worth their weight in gold because they are the first contact normally that the veteran comes in contact with, and they, you know, they're not as highly trained certainly as a raider is in the Veterans Administration because they have so many other duties that they perform. But that's a great first contact, is a county veteran service officer when they file their claim. And certainly the county veteran service officers, if they look at the claim and they can, they feel they need additional medical evidence, I mean, they can find somebody like Dr. Bash, and certainly Dr. Bash is available. So, I mean, you know, there are other, and the same with the national veterans organizations. They're excellent. They're highly trained. Problem with both of them is that they're so busy. They're so overwhelmed with numbers, and it gets into detail. It takes time. It takes hours and hours of analyzing exactly what's needed here. They don't have that amount of time normally. It's like, next.
Oh, I agree. They can't even remember people's names. And it's not because they're not good people or don't want to help you. It's just they're overrun.
Absolutely it is. Yeah. So we need more of that rather than less, you know. We need more resources like that. Of course, there are very few doctors like Dr. Bashan.
Well, that's true, because not only does Dr. Bash have the medical credentials, but he has the understanding of how the VA works and what the VA is looking for. And, of course, with you as an administrative assistant coming at it, with your point of view from being a writer, I can say that just adds up to help the veteran. That's added value into the opinion, and is what
we hope so. We hope so. That's we're trying to help the veteran. That's the bottom line. And, you know, I represent veterans myself. And when and my website suggests, look, I highly recommend Dr. Bash or somebody like him. I give credence to the county veterans officers and the national veterans organization saying, go there if you want to get this done without me charging them something. But still, you're going to need a medical opinion.
Right.
And if you can get it from your local doctor, wonderful. But chances are the local doctor, he may be able to develop this and provide the type of opinion you're looking for. He may not. It's hard to say.
Something else, speaking about the local doctor, one thing I've used sometimes, because the VA tried to gang up on me with multiple medical opinions, you know, and I'll use the local doctor as a review of my opinion. If he concurs with my opinion, then I add some
excellent point. I've done that. I've done that a number of times, Dr. Bash. You know that.
My opinion first, and the local doctor.
Oh, absolutely. Taking your independent medical evaluation and provided the veteran gets it. And the veteran can do what they want with it, of course. And if they bring it to their doctor and the doctor also looks at the claims file and reviews it, they get a much better understanding as to what it is that we're trying to accomplish here. Legitimately, the veteran was injured in service or had an illness in service, still has it, and legitimately should be service-connected for it.
In my opinion, it explains it to local doctors so they can understand what the VA is looking for. That's why it's useful.
Right. I mean, it's a shame that we even need independent medical opinions, but that is the world that we exist in now.
Right.
And
I told you my case took 7 years, and I was a physician, so I was like going crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Dr. Bassett, did you have a problem with when you filed your claim? Did they did they actually count your opinion, or did they try to discount it?
I didn't do my own opinion. I just thought that mine would be pretty straightforward, you know?
You naive boy.
Yeah, I didn't know. So then I had to have my doctor. I had my doctor write. That was my first thing. I didn't know. And so my doctor had to write like 6 letters. It was unbelievable. He didn't know what he was doing. You know, I lived this whole thing from patient side.
Yeah. Right. Well, I certainly understand that. That's sort of how I started my website.
You know, sure. The other. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Dr. Bash. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, John.
Well, I was just going to say it's imperative that the veterans who are listening understand too. When they get involved with filing a claim, I mean, the underlying theme, the underlying thing that needs to be understood is patience. The timeliness, the amount of work that goes into developing a claim from the VA perspective is that, look, it takes time. There's rules and regulations that are mandated to send out a letter for development. They're mandated to wait 30 or 60 days. And then they don't get to it right away because, again, they're overwhelmed by numbers. They clearly are overwhelmed by numbers. And it's gotten worse, not better, with how many people file because of the number of wars we're having, you know. That's mm-hmm. obvious, and it goes back all the way to World War II yet. So the point is that patience is the watchword. It's going to take a long time to get that decision, the initial decision, and it takes a long time to get the next decision if you have to appeal it. It's not normally a quick turnaround.
I understand that, but I've had, on the same side, you know, the medical side, if somebody has something that's urgent, acute, or needs medical treatment or medications, and I'm not afraid to put pressure on the VA. And I've had been to some cases in 2 weeks for patients that have things that are bad.
Right.
So, you know,
what's your hourly rate that you charge for an IME?
I don't really talk about rates. I negotiate with each patient. I talk to them, and it's based on how many claims they have and how thick the file is and how much work I have to do. And then I usually give them a flat rate, so when I tell them the price, that's what the price is. So that's kind of the way I do my fee. And I use my fee to keep me going and help the next patient in line, so that's kind of the way it works.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Dr. Bash, you're not able to take it on a contingency. I mean,
Not. I don't do any contingency work because then the VA will say my opinion is biased based on the outcome, so I don't do that. But,
yeah, that's true. You
know, that's always good protection, Dr. Bash. Very good deal.
And Joe, you would have to review the entire claims folder to give yourself an estimate about how much time it's going to take of you.
Usually what I do is I can talk to them on the phone. You know, I've been at this a while, so I know, and I make mistakes on the price, but that's okay. I just do it as best I can. But I talk to them on the phone, get an idea what the issues are, and then how much work's going to be involved, and I give them a price, and that's what I stick to.
Oh, good. And then it's a flat fee, so the veteran doesn't have to worry that you're going to say, oh, well, it took me 5 extra hours to do this.
Exactly. Right. That's a lawyered way I do try and do on a flat fee. And then, and I stick with them. Like down the road, if I have to do more extensive work, then I might charge a discounted fee for a letter in the future. But I've had letters later on, like 4, 5, 6 years later, and the patient brings the records back to me, and we see what the VA has done, and we go back at it again.
Right.
So I'm not, if I write my first letter, I'm going to stick with them because I believe in what I wrote the first time. So I'm not going to be, there's no external forces on me from outside. You know, there's no VA force on me or government force or anything. My allegiance is to the patient. So I help them as much as I can within the rules and, you know, medicine is there.
Right. As it should be.
That's good.
John, you said you had a website. Do you want to give that out for our listeners?
Sure. It's www.vaappealsagent.com.
Okay. If anybody wants to check that out.
Appeals, vaappealsagent.com. Yeah. I'm what they call an accredited agent. So as a former rating specialist and decision review officer, I was able to, after I retired a couple of years ago, I enjoyed this too much. And I collaborated with Dr. Bash and was helping him for a while, but then I decided to become accredited. And so I represent veterans, and I, only now am I able to represent Minnesota veterans because I worked in St. Paul regional office. So it's been 2 years since I last worked there. Mm-hmm. So just this month I'll start working there. But I do represent veterans, you know, across the country. I've got some clients in different states and so forth. And I try and you know, if that veteran wishes to use Dr. Bash, then I point him in that direction because I know the product I'm going to get.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, there are some resources. I think if you find my website, you can find John's and Haddett's, and if you find Haddett's, you can find John. We're all kind of linked together, I think, in the website world.
It's a network.
You guys got a pretty good tag team there.
Well, you know, this is complicated. You know, that's a good point. This is complicated stuff, and I know the medicine pretty well, and John knows the VA rules, and you know, there's lots of both sides of that. So, if we start doing, if I try and do the rule stuff too much, I can make mistakes and vice versa. So, you know, it's complicated.
Well, you know, perhaps I could borrow Hillary Clinton's line and say it takes a village to get your claim approved.
It is so true, though, that it takes a network. Whether it's the county veterans officer, you're collaborating with them, or the national Disabled American Veterans or Paralyzed Veterans of America, or with Dr. Bash providing a medical opinion, or the private doctor providing a medical opinion, it is networking and communication that's going to spell success for a veteran. It takes a lot of time to educate that veteran.
Oh, yes.
What's interesting is that the Raider, you know, the Raider has resources. So an old-time Raider claims guy told me that you try and give the Raider what they need. So if he needs medicine, I try and give him the medicine part so that if he goes out to a medical consultant that he has access to, my purpose is to have that medical consultant agree with my opinion because that makes the process simpler and it's more accurate.
You're so right.
And the same thing on the legal side. So if the Raider goes out and gets a legal expert or a Raider expert like John, John's going to agree with the Raider part of it because the work's already been done for the Raiders. So that's all part of that village stuff you're talking about on the Raider side, and we try and feed it to them on the front side so it makes your job easy.
Right. Keep it simple. And, you know, it's now, I don't know if you agree with me or not, but, you know, I try to tell my veterans to just keep it like a knife, just as sharp as possible and thin. You don't need to give them extraneous tons of information.
Well, you hit it again. It's so true that if you have a nice clean file with the proper evidence in it and things are just kind of stacked without – some 3 or 4 or 5 inches worth of medical records that are being submitted that don't even apply to it sometimes. Sometimes less is better.
But that's
to
right.
Have enough medical evidence and have it just, like you say, it's a, what is it, keep it simple, stupid was the philosophy that, you know, I learned about. And
right.
It just says, let's just keep it simple. Let's provide the evidence, as Dr. Bash said, that they need in order to, that's what they're looking for. If they have the evidence, they're going to grant it.
You know,
that's
Bert,
right.
You have a good point about that sharp edge, and the way I get to that is when I do each patient I talk to in a clinical interview. When I'm talking to them in that clinical interview, I work through the extraneous data and make it really sharp. And that's something that the VA doctors don't do, or the QTC does. But a lot of times the VA guys, they have reviewed the records without seeing the patient. Doesn't have the ability to talk to the patient and to sharpen that edge and what the issues are.
Right. I agree. Documentation is everything, but not an overload of documentation. The right amount of documentation translated into the right words, and I think it's, you know, service officers are great. I think working with your service officer and a website like mine or any number of other websites that are out there to help veterans and learning as much as you can and working in a partnership with your service officer is probably the best thing, the best way to get started. It's a partnership, and it's a long, hard road.
It is. It's not easy.
Dr. Batch, what are some of the worst things a veteran can do? You or John, either one. I mean, as far as trying to develop their claim, I think a lot of them, probably like myself and some of the others, put in a lot of information that's not really pertinent or actually ends up hurting them on their claim.
Yeah, the don't lose your medical records.
Yeah.
when you leave service, get copies of all that stuff, and redundancy. You know, sometimes patients send in more stuff, but I recommend, like with my medical opinion, send in a couple times because the VA can lose it. And make sure, you know, get a copy of your claims file after the record goes in. Make sure you have my record in there, whatever data you want. The other thing that they do sometimes hurt themselves is when they go. The paper records aren't so much a problem, but the hearings can be a problem. Like when they go to a verbal hearing, they can, you know, the judge will start asking questions and the patient might get confused. Because some of these patients have maybe a serious head injury, like the guys you have in the war zone now, or MS patients and things like that. And they go and then they can get confused about the dates and times, and their story becomes, you know, not consistent, and that kind of stuff can be very harmful.
I'll tell you something else is, because this happened to me, I had so much anxiety about going to a CUP exam that I took my Xanax and my Seroquel, and I don't even know what the hell I said.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I was trying to answer all the
funny.
Questions.
It's not funny, but it's so true.
It's true.
Yeah, I've taken many veterans to the VA Medical Center. I was a county veterans officer for 17 years, too. And... So, I mean, I took many veterans to compensation and pension exams, and it is so anxiety, it's so anxiety-ridden for them. And, boy, I'll tell you, it's just a nerve-wracking experience, but you've got to go through it.
Oh, you absolutely must show up for your C&P exams.
Well, the other thing a veteran does oftentimes is, in service, you know, we're taught to be stoic and not complain. So I always tell them that when they go to the exams and so on, this is the time not to be stoic, this is the time to present the data, you know, and the, kind of how it is, not necessarily how you think it should be. You know,
well, you know, Dr. Bash, that is an excellent point because every veteran I know has been taught to suck it up. And that is not the time nor the place to suck it up.
Right.
And it, you know, this person is making judgments about whether you're disabled or not, not whether or not you're a good soldier or a good person.
Right.
And, you know, but, you know, the military is good at a lot of things. It's good at teaching us to suck things up. It's good at teaching us to be leaders. But it's not a touchy-feely kind of environment where we're taught to talk about our feelings or our pains.
Right.
And so it really, I think, is extremely difficult for veterans going into their C&P exam to understand that. And the other problem I have is that you have a veteran and he or she is just a mess. They're just a mess. And then they have a spouse or a partner who, on the day of the C&P exam, gets that poor veteran up 3 hours early, gets them all dressed up in their fine Sunday suit, and takes them off to the VA. Well, if that's not... I tell people, if you want to dress your veteran up, take them out to dinner. But if that's... Because that's just not the way it is. And everything in the C&P exam is important. Not only what you say, but how you look, what you look like. I mean, they need to see an accurate picture of what's going on.
That's right.
I agree. You know, you're talking about the appeals process earlier and the judge and so forth. I mean, the process, if it's initially denied, of course, and a person files a notice of disagreement, that's when a person would consider hiring an agent like myself or an attorney. That's a new law that was passed in 2008. And before that, the attorneys weren't allowed to be paid for representing veterans to speak of. So that's a new process, but what I really wanted to emphasize was the fact that within the regional office appeals process, when a notice of disagreement is filed when there's an initial denial, I think that the VA regional offices all have what they call decision review officers, and they have they've been given a lot of latitude to look at the entire file. They've been given what they call de novo presence, where they can look at the entire file and make an independent decision. And if that's when you really want to, if you want to get a quicker decision, you certainly would ask for a decision review officer, and you can have an informal conference or a formal hearing with the decision review officer at the regional office without waiting a year for it to get on the dock at the Board of Veterans Appeals. And it's very communicative and informal, and it's a good process is all I'm reinforcing here.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the DROs also. If you can get one, I think that's a good way to go if you have a pretty...
They have a lot of power. Yeah, you know, I went to a hearing for a veteran in Baltimore, and they were going to sever him for dialysis. I was there at the hearing, and the decision review officer said, you know, you wrote this letter for a patient, and went upstairs, picked the form up, came it down, and the patient signed it, and it was all done. Didn't even,
wow.
That's so true. It's so true, Dr.
They have a lot of power, right, John? Decision review
officer. They have a lot of power, and they're there to try and sort through to see... No, and to share. What evidence is it that you, they want to share? What is the evidence that is needed in order to perfect this appeal, in order to grant it? And if they can delay it for 30 days and prevent it from having to go to the Board of Veterans Appeals, it just stops the backlog, too. So there's a lot of good reasons. They want to be fair to the veteran. They want the evidence. They'll tell them what evidence is needed, and if they can grant it, they will. That's the truth of the matter.
I believe that, too.
Yep.
With the decision review officers, I've had good experience personally with that myself, and I've talked to other veterans who've had very good experiences with that.
Yep.
And they have a lot of power, like Dr. Bash and John said. So, you know, you can sort of like, you know, I mean, you want that. You don't want to go to the BVA if you don't have to. Because if you think it's long now.
Yeah. Well, and the BVA, you know, that you have options there, too, with having a televised, interactive type of option. In other words, you can go to the regional office and you can wait until your time comes. They'll notify you. It probably takes a year. But they'll notify you that, okay, we're going to have your representative, the veteran's representative and the veteran go to the regional office. They look at the screen. There's the judge in Washington on the other end. And the hearing is held that way.
Let me say a word about that. I've gone to those hearings, those video hearings, and I can be the expert on this side with the judge in Washington.
Yes. Yeah.
That works. But and I also can go to the BVA hearings, but for the patient to speed it up, the wait time for the in-person hearings is less than it is for the traveling boards, for sure. You know, the travel boards are really slow. And even faster, the in-person hearings are faster than the video hearings. Now, the in-person hearings and the video, the judges give the patients a lot more time than they do, like, at the travel board. So, like, when we go to a hearing in person in D.C., the judge could sit there for a couple hours, doesn't care. Whereas a travel board, they have, like, 11 cases scheduled a day or whatever, so they're much quicker and the veteran doesn't really have as much chance to say.
Gives it an hour each, maybe, or something like that.
Oh, less than that. They give less than that. They have less, yeah.
Good point, Dr. Bash. Excellent. It's so true.
Gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to start winding this down here. Appreciate you, both of you, coming on, Dr. Bash and John. Would you be willing to come back and do another broadcast with us here?
Yeah, sure.
A pleasure having you on, and you've given out some really great information. And I want you to know that this will be kept in our archives so that the members or anyone wanting to review this show, they can, you know, and so it'll come in helpful to a lot of veterans out there.
If we do one in the future, you could pick some scenarios or maybe some specific topic. You know, patient had this, that, and the other thing, and we could tackle them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we will.
And, John, if you send me John, if you send me an email, then I can send you a link to the archive show if you want to put it on your website so people can.
Oh, nice. That's wonderful. I thank you very much. I'll have to get the. I'm like I said, I'm still in the car in the parking lot.
Yeah.
So I don't even have a pen with me, for crying out loud. That's ridiculous.
Dr. Bash has my email address. Just ask him for it.
I sure will.
And then just
link mine too. Yeah, we'll talk to my webmaster and get linked up.
Yeah, and that way you guys can have it there, and it'll be helpful for your audience as well, I'm sure.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for inviting me, Dr. Bash, and to you folks, too. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk to you again.
That sounds great, John. Thank you.
I like that idea. Grant if you can and deny if you must. I like that.
I do, too.
That's the way it should be. Yep.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Thank you, Dr.
And, thank you, Dr. Mack.
Thank you, John. And you too, T-Bird. So this really made a great show for the audience out there and the ones that are working, what have you, that don't get a chance till tonight to listen. I think you'll enjoy it. A lot of good information.
Thank you very much for the invite.
Sure thing, Dr. Bash. Thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye, John.
Bye now.
And this will be Gerald Cook with the SVR broadcast. Sponsored by the Haddit website. We'll be signing off for now.